don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Crypto Economy Quick Read. What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Crypto Economy Podcast. If you did not listen to yesterday's episode, you need to, because this is a part two of a two-part series. We're jumping right into the middle of Daniel Goldman's article, The Lightning Network 2.0, and it's going over a lot of the innovations and new tools that are being used and utilized by clients and protocols that are getting around some of the major limitations of Lightning, like the routing issues, the liquidity issues, so on and so forth. So we are jumping right in on channel factories. If you have not listened to yesterday's episode, you're going to be confused. So go back and listen to 139, and that's Lightning Network 2.0 Part 1, and then come back here and we will jump off. But without further ado, let's start back at channel factories. I feel obligated to warn you, shit is about to get weird. We know from vanilla Lightning how to construct a system where theoretically only transactions that open and close two-party state channels need to be sent to the main chain. Could we establish a mechanism, one might well ask, such that even those transactions won't need to be broadcast? More specifically, a mechanism by which many parties could enter a different type of state channel, where in between its opening and closing, any two parties could effectively open and close a two-party state channel with each other without having to do so on-chain each time. That's right. While we're here still trying to wrap our minds around layer 2 solutions, these mad scientists are already proposing a system with 3 layers. The two-party state channels we're familiar with from vanilla Lightning get bumped up to layer 3. Back down on layer 1, the blockchain itself, sits an N of N multi-sig funding transaction. In between these sits a layer 2 channel factory, upon which pairs of parties can open and close channels without touching the blockchain. The benefit here, if it isn't clear, is that this joint venture provides its members with major flexibility in partnering up to forward payments along, liquidity and routing possibilities galore. How it works. Okay, to really exploit the benefits of this arrangement, you'd want many parties to commit, perhaps around 10. But to keep things from going too hog wild, let's assume there are 4 parties involved. Our beloved Alice and Bob, who, in an effort to liven things up, now bring Claire and Derek into the mix. First, the 4 of them put their Bitcoin into the initial funding transaction. Let's assume they deposit 2 Bitcoin each, so the balance is Alice 2, Bob 2, Claire 2, and Derek 2. Now say Alice and Claire decide they would like to enter a two-party channel together with 1 Bitcoin contributed from each of them. The 2 of them broadcast an allocation transaction, this step is analogous to the funding transactions in vanilla Lightning, to the rest of the channel's party participants, but not to the blockchain. They all verify that the 2 of them each do indeed have 1 Bitcoin available and sign off on this request. At the end of this exchange, each party will have a copy of the allocation transaction signed by all parties except themselves. Thus, everybody agrees it's valid, and everybody has the ability to settle it on the main chain. This new allocation transaction represents the latest canonical state of the channel, which now looks like this. Alice 1, Bob 2, Claire 1, Derek 2, Alice and Claire together, 2 in total. At this point, since they've all agreed on this allocation transaction, Alice and Claire can trade on top of their joint 2 Bitcoin, vanilla Lightning style, without informing the rest of the group. What they do behind closed doors is nobody else's business. Now suppose that Claire wants to open up another channel with Bob using her remaining one Bitcoin. A new allocation transaction is passed around and signed just as before, replacing the old state with the new one. Alice 1, Bob 1, Claire 0, Derek 2, Alice and Claire together, 2 total, Bob and Claire together, 2 total. Now Bob and Claire can trade between each other on layer 3, and so on. What we have is a transaction tree structure. Everybody knows that any transaction is valid so long as they can follow it up the tree to a transaction that can be settled. So let's talk on-chain settlement. Can Claire settle one of her commitment transactions in her layer 3 channel with Bob? Yes, but not right away. Her commitment transaction spins from an allocation transaction that itself lives off-chain, after all. However, recall she has the power to broadcast that transaction herself. So to settle, she must first broadcast the allocation transaction, and then she can claim her funds with her commitment transactions. Any sort of arbitration or revocation that needs to occur at that point plays out exactly as it would with a vanilla Lightning channel, because at this point, that's effectively all it is. A more troubling question is, how do we enforce valid settlement of those allocation transactions? We said earlier that the latest one represents the canonical state of the channel factory, but what's to stop somebody from broadcasting an old, outdated state? One can imagine a way of preventing this using a revocation and punishment model a la vanilla Lightning. The problem is, we now have more than two parties, so the punishment can't simply be, quote, slash the dishonest party's funds and give everything to the other party. We would need some way to punish one party and then somehow distribute the right funds to everybody else. This would get messy. So instead, the channel factory mechanism for ensuring that the latest allocation transaction gets settled burrows an alternative state channel strategy known as duplex micropayment channels, or DMCs, which instead of relying on punishment, relies on having transactions validity, quote, unlock over time. Details in the next section. Sit tight. In sum, there are three levels of statefulness that need to be kept track of. Layer 3 state channels, or really off-chain, that are maintained by the two parties involved. The Layer 2 stack of allocation transactions, just barely off-chain, maintained by all in our case 4, members of the channel factory. And finally, the good old-fashioned Layer 1, maintained by the Bitcoin ecosystem at large, where parties settle their debts on the public ledger, just like our ancestors did. Is this all getting complicated? Well, yes. Too complicated? Hard to say. Though I suppose once we're willing to consider blockchain-bound state channels, which themselves are blockchains, which themselves can spawn other blockchains, link, all bets are off. I myself do have a number of questions. Is there really no collusion strategy here? Wouldn't trying to route through on these things get a bit tangled? But I hesitate to further explicate since I can feel a migraine starting to form, so probably best to just move on. Related tangent. Duplex micropayment channels? I mentioned that enforcing settlement of the proper allocation transaction in channel factories is achieved using the duplex micropayment channel, or DMC, method. DMCs are a mechanism for two or more party state channels that achieves a similar result to the better known Lightning channels, but do so using a different strategy. If, once again, the fundamental question of state channels is, how do we make sure that only the bottom line of the balance sheet gets broadcast? A Lightning channel's answer is, well, if someone broadcasts any other line of the balance sheet, the other party can punish them by taking all of their money. Alternatively, the DMC's answer is, let's ensure that there is a window of time in which only the bottom line can be broadcast, and any other line will be considered invalid. So, for example, the first transaction in a DMC could include a condition that it will only be considered valid if it is included in a block 10 days later. The second would have a condition that it will be valid only after 9 days. The third, after 8 days, etc. Say Alice and Bob work their way down to a transaction that has a 3-day waiting period and then stop there. After 3 days, there will be a 24-hour period in which that transaction, and only that transaction, can be broadcast. As long as Bob can act fast enough, example, he doesn't dilly-dally for more than a day, he's guaranteed his money. Keen observers will notice that, as described above, DMCs have a major weakness compared to the Lightning Network model. Channels have a limited lifespan. In the example above, the channel would stay open for, at most, 10 days, and even that lifetime gets slashed by a day with each additional transaction. This obstacle, however, can be cleverly circumvented. Instead of starting the, quote, timer at the initial funding transaction, we can start the timer only when and if the adjudication process starts, which is initiated by an intermediary kickoff transaction. Once the maximum number of transactions is reached, 10 in our example, parties can mutually agree to effectively reset it, or in other words, branching off and starting a new transaction stack and bringing the time delay back up to 10. This requirement for regular resets, along with a few other factors, make DMCs an arguably weaker alternative to the Lightning channels we know and love. However, when it comes to channel factories, using timing instead of punishment becomes a more suitable option, since this scales better to situations with more than two participants. And thus, a DMC-style system is used to enforce allocation transaction settlement. Payment loops. As a chaser, here's a fairly simple one. Say Alice has a channel she could use for a payment to Bob if it had enough funds, and another open channel that does have a lot of funds. To rebalance her own channel, she can simply pay herself via the Lightning Network from one channel to the other, providing, of course, that such a payment loop exists. If indeed it does, this channel balancing procedure takes place entirely off-chain. Cheap, fast, and sleek. Other thoughts. Many of the above proposals involve the rebalancing of one's payment channels. Ideally, this would be something handled without the user having to be aware of the exact mechanism involved. However, all of the proposals above involve at least sending an off-chain payment, which cost money, and some, splicing and submarine swaps, include at least one on-chain payment, which costs more money. This starts to get us into, quote, automated micropayments territory, and as has been convincingly argued, Link, consumers aren't going to accept automated micropayments anytime soon, for the simple reason that humans don't like the psychological burden of knowing a computer is repeatedly deciding how to spend their money. Subscription-style services, on the other hand, in which a strict upper bound is given to the amount of money a user will be charged over a given period of time, is something we can and indeed have adapted to. Thus, providing an experience where a user can effectively say, quote, I'm willing to spend X per month at most for you to use whatever wizardry you want to keep my channels more liquid, end quote. Or for routing nodes, perhaps, quote, I'm willing to pay X percent of my routing fee profits, end quote, should be the aim here. A user would reap the benefits of channel rebalancing strategies while having the psychological peace of mind of knowing that no algorithm will decide that it behooves the greater good of Bitcoin scaling to drain their retirement savings, so to speak. On another note, finding topological network structures that would be conducive to maximizing available liquidity is still a ripe area for research. One simple but compelling example of these sorts of arrangements is cyclic payments, proposed by Lightning Network developers and as Revive in by the Liquidity Network project. In essence, Alice has a channel with Bob, Bob with Claire, and Claire back with Alice, and payments tend to flow around the loop unidirectionally, naturally making the liquidity more balanced and available. Again, there's no surefire way to structure a decentralized network, but if subnetwork structures are proven effective, higher throughput and thus higher routing fees could naturally incentivize more parties to adopt them. Players could even encourage others to open up channels that facilitate such topologies via negative routing fees. Problem 2. Liveness. For any digital payment system, one must have some sort of connection to the internet to send out a transaction. That's just kind of how the internet works. However, when it comes to the Lightning Network, or any other non-custodial Layer 2 scaling solutions for that matter, having live internet access and a bit of bandwidth to spare becomes a necessity for other vital features, namely routing others' payments, receiving payments of one's own, and securing one's funds. While all three of these things are obviously important, the big one here is security, which will be the main focus of this section. The security model for individual ownership of Bitcoin, beyond relying on the general security and persistence of the network itself, is simply that a user must keep their private keys secret. End of story. Lightning adds another layer. For fund security, one must still secure their private keys and also have the ability to monitor the main chain and to potentially broadcast transactions within an allotted time slot. Any change in the security model is something to take seriously. So let's. Watchtowers. A semi-controversial suggestion for easing the necessity of liveness is to use watchtowers. Watchtowers are third-party nodes that you could hire to monitor the chain for you and broadcast revocation transactions on your behalf if and when the need arises. The big question here is, are we just outsourcing trust to a third party? And if so, what the hell are we doing here? If a watchtower is simply given a signed transaction, that watchtower has custody over your funds, no way around it. However, there is a better way. Say I want to give my watchtower the ability to revoke a transaction with ID 12345678900. What I do is, I create the relevant revocation transaction, signed and all. I then encrypt it using the secret 67890, the second half of the target transaction ID. What I then share with the watchtower is this encrypted blob and the string 12345, the first half of the transaction ID. So what's the point of all this? If, and only if, the transaction that needs revoking gets broadcast, the watchtower will be able to spot it from the first half of its ID, at which point they can retrieve the second half of the ID, decrypt my revocation transaction, and broadcast it. If the transaction in question never gets broadcast, which is most likely, all the watchtower has is a useless blob of data. In other words, the only time a watchtower actually gets my transaction is when I want them to have it anyway. So have we found a truly trustless watchtower system? Well, not quite. Even though the watchtower can't directly run off with my money, what they can do is, well, nothing. For example, if they simply sit idly after an unauthorized broadcast, my counterparty ends up with my funds. God forbid they even collude with my counterparty and ultimately share the bounty. So ultimately, what we can say is that this arrangement, quote, can't hurt and is, quote, better than nothing, and could certainly provide a second layer of fallback protection to mitigate risk of one's node failing. But as far as I can tell, full reliance on third-party watchtowers should, in principle, be considered a trustful relationship. Compact block filters for SPV clients. Ultimately, the safest way to use Lightning and the safest way to use Bitcoin itself is by running a full node. Major merchants and exchanges can and should continue to do so. However, it isn't reasonable to ask the average user to run their own node, We don't all have 170 gigabytes of hard drive space and 15 gigabytes a day of bandwidth to spare. When it comes to Layer 1 transaction verification and validation, Lite SPV clients let users have some of the self-verification security without running a full node themselves. In essence, a full node can send the Lite client enough information, the transaction in question, and a Merkle proof to its block hash, for the Lite client to verify for itself that the transaction is indeed included in the block. For Lightning Network security, however, we need the opposite. Not proof of the presence of a given transaction, but proof of the absence of certain transactions, namely transactions closing one of our channels. A different type of Lite client can accomplish exactly this using compact block filters. The idea here is that full nodes expose a, quote, filtered block to any listening Lite client. Now, instead of a Lite client requesting data for relevant transactions, the client can examine the filter and probabilistically determine whether their transaction in question could be included. The key here is that the client cannot get any false negatives. The data structure is such that the answer is either your transaction is definitely not in this block, this will be the answer most of the time, or your transaction might be in this block. In the latter case, the client can then simply request the full block in question, verify it against their own block headers, and then act accordingly. As for verifying that block filters do indeed accurately represent their corresponding block's data, block filters have filter headers that bear an analogous relationship to blocks as block headers do. The headers are mapped from the data itself, and each header is chained to the previous one. By downloading all of the headers, cross-referencing them against several different nodes, and occasionally verifying them directly against their corresponding blocks, a node can be confident that the filter headers it receives are accurate. Net result: self-verification that all channels are still open, no full node required. Another issue associated with liveness is the fact that it necessarily makes any Lightning Network node a hot wallet. This opens up the risk of an out-of-date commitment transaction accidentally being signed and broadcast, either by user error or a software bug or an attacker gaining access to the node's OS, at which point your counterparty could slash your funds, essentially punishing you for a crime you didn't commit. L2 is yet another trustless multi-party state channel mechanism that makes three that mitigates this particular risk. This time, the answer to the canonical "what happens when outdated transactions get broadcast?" question is, those transactions will be considered perfectly valid, but any later transaction from the channel will then be able to replace it. The mechanism behind this is as follows. Every time a member of the channel wants to send a payment, the parties, we'll assume there are only two for this example, create a pair of transactions, a settlement transaction and an update transaction. Settlement transactions are analogous to commitment transactions from vanilla Lightning. They distribute Bitcoin from the funding transaction to both parties in the channel. Once broadcast, a period exists where an update transaction can be broadcast. This transaction, assuming it's sent within the allotted time, also spins from the funding transaction and creates a new output almost identical to the previous one, effectively nullifying the settlement transaction and keeping the channel open to be resettled, updated, etc. in the future. A key difference with this new output is that it specifies a higher sequence number than before. A sequence number is also associated with each update transaction. These sequence numbers enforce ordering, the rule being simply that as arbitration plays out, the sequence numbers must increase. This ensures that updates only go forward in time, and thus guaranteeing that an honest party always has a chance to broadcast their most up-to-date settlement transaction. The net result here is that in the case of an arbitration, we end up settling with the balances that each party is owed. No punishments are doled out. Beyond just mitigating the risk of punishing an innocent actor, L2 has an added bonus. Thanks to the SIG hash no input flag, update transactions behave as floating transactions, meaning they can be used to nullify any attempted settlement with a lower sequence number than their own. Thus, the only pieces of data that a party needs to hold on to are the latest update and settlement transactions, compared to vanilla Lightning channels, in which a revocation transaction needs to be kept for each commitment. This means easier, simpler state management for everyone. Other thoughts. Something to note about the liveness requirement for security is that you don't need constant liveness, but rather only frequent enough liveness. Say, for example, the challenge period for a Lightning channel is 1 week. This means that as long as a node stays less than 5 days behind, that node is guaranteed to have a 2-day window to revoke, if necessary. Given the possibility for a block filtering light client described above, this bar is very easy to reach. The device running the node could have the Lightning software running in the background, limiting the amount of processing power it uses to what's currently available. Should it start getting too close to the 5-day limit, it could simply alert the user explicitly. There's also the possibility of having alert systems that exist entirely separate from the Lightning network. This system wouldn't interact with the chain itself, but simply alert the user of relevant activity so the user can act accordingly. Various block explorers already support things like email notifications for activity around subscribed addresses. These sorts of things could be tooled to support Lightning. Better yet, some sort of decentralized messaging ecosystem could emerge. This data is very public after all, so it shouldn't be too hard to get it to whoever wants to subscribe to it. I've got some ideas on this front. Stay tuned. As with watchtowers, these alert systems shouldn't be relied on as the primary mechanism for security, but between these, watchtowers, and the user's node itself, the ecosystem could have enough layers of protection that the odds of sneaking something past a user becomes negligible. Finally, one additional piece of the Lightning security model worth noting is the threat of a hard drive crash. Any Bitcoiner knows that losing a private key means losing one's money, and thus one should have their private keys backed up in multiple places. When it comes to Lightning, there's an additional piece of data that ought to be backed up for trustlessly securing funds: transaction data itself. However, unlike private keys, which are static and unchanging, and thus only need to be backed up once, transaction data grows over time, every time you receive a new payment, thus making backups more of an ongoing process. Fortunately, backing up Lightning transaction data is also, in a different way, easier. A commitment transaction need not be signed by you until you send it, and thus need not be treated as secret, vulnerable data, so there's no trust risk to simply storing a copy somewhere in the cloud. For the self-reliance purists, a simple, cheap hardware backup device could connect to the device running your node and dump in copies of your commitment transactions as they come in. Ledger Trezor, perhaps? Problem 3. Routing. In the liquidity section, we address the question of how do we increase the likelihood of a payment route between Alice and Bob existing, and what do we do if there isn't one? That problem is one that is fairly unique to Lightning, and thus merits serious analysis. With that problem aside, we are still left with a milder and, frankly, less interesting problem. Even if there is a route between Alice and Bob, how are the two of them supposed to find it? I say, quote, less interesting because this isn't particularly unique to Lightning or public blockchain protocols, and gets us more into the wonky realm of routing in peer-to-peer networks in general. Some, like Andreas Antonopoulos notably, predict that as the Lightning network grows, the routing mechanisms will organically evolve along with it to keep up with its capacity needs, taking a similar trajectory to the evolution of routing mechanisms for the internet itself. Thus, we need not speculate and map out exact routing strategies in advance. It is worth pointing out that routing in Lightning is, in at least one way, fundamentally more difficult than routing around the World Wide Web as we know it. Many components of routing architecture on the net, like the Border Gateway Protocol, are explicitly trust-based. The Lightning network obviously doesn't have this luxury, However, even routing data in open peer-to-peer systems is hardly a new field of study. So why is it then that the, quote, routing problem is such a battle cry for Lightning critics? The sense I get that by routing, many are really referring to the Section 1 channel liquidity problem. Being clearer on this distinction would probably clear up some confusion. But with all that said, it seems worth giving an overview, if only briefly, of what a routing strategy geared specifically toward the architecture of Lightning would look like. All sorts of ideas have been floated around, many of which were consolidated into the Flare white paper. A state snapshot of the Lightning network essentially comes down to four dynamic variables. 1. Existence of channels. 2. Amount of funding in channels. 3. Routing fees. And 4. Liveness of nodes. Of these, one could reasonably expect that 2 to 4 would be changing very rapidly, whereas the existence of a channel itself would alter comparatively rarely. Thus, the strategy for maintaining network state is to keep channel existence up to date proactively. In other words, a node, for all intents and purposes, knows the state of all the channels it cares about all the time. Alternatively, the information in 2 to 4 is obtained reactively. Only when a node is making or receiving a payment does it bother digging in to find it. It's strictly a need-to-know basis. Using this hybrid strategy, each node constructs its own routing table, which stores paths of nodes within that node's neighborhood, and a neighborhood being all of the nodes that are within N channel hops away. Additionally, each node has a randomly selected group of beacon nodes. These beacon nodes are simply other nodes in Lightning from which a node uses to get a random snapshot of data about sections of the network outside of its neighborhood. When Alice and Bob wish to find a route between them, they check for overlaps in their own neighborhoods, then check for overlaps among the collective nodes they have access to via their beacons, and finally, if necessary, start polling their peers for additional data until a path is found. Flare borrows from the CJDNS proposal a strategy of assigning node addresses, the assignment of unique identifiers, to each node, from which the node distance between two nodes can be calculated. This distance is not the same as the number of channel hops between nodes. Rather, it represents something more abstract, but in short, it gives a probabilistic answer to the question, how likely is it that these two nodes has information that's useful to each other? A metric that guides the polling process described above. In sum, there's a straw man that gets repeated that for Lightning to function, each node needs a perfect view of the rapidly changing state of the network. As we can see, though, there are a number of strategies to employ that attempt to optimize the trade-offs between memory, computation and bandwidth, and time that seek to achieve the necessary functionality using a whole lot less effort. Lastly, the trustlessness of the relationships between nodes introduces risks of new types of denial-of-service attacks. A node could theoretically broadcast fraudulent data about the state of its channel and peers, tricking Alice into thinking a route is available when it isn't, wasting her precious time. To help mitigate this, we can introduce channel proofs. Parties can and should send data verifying that the channel state really is what they say it is. The proofs outlined in Flare involve a combination of SPV-style Merkle proofs to prove that the channel is in fact still open on the blockchain, in addition to a new authentication system that lets parties verify and sign off on the Layer 2 state of the channel's transactions. So while we cannot, and perhaps need not, predict exactly what Lightning Network routing will look like, we can take comfort in knowing that it at least could look something like that. Final thoughts. Congratulations, you made it. And what a journey it's been. Having gone over all of this, it's hard to avoid concluding that this whole Lightning thing is going to be a rather complex, radical experiment. Complexity, though, may just be the nature of the beast here. As wary as I am of early days of the internet cliches, it seems applicable in this case. New ideas introduce new challenges, which in turn require novel solutions. And the history of scientific progress has shown us that goal-directed research can yield all sorts of fruitful results, even results that are applicable and useful for other things entirely. So even if nothing else, it ought to continue to be fascinating to watch how this all plays out. And as for, quote, radical? Well, yes. But if radical experiments aren't your thing, you probably aren't involved in cryptocurrency to begin with. In which case, you probably aren't even reading this, in which case this sentence has an audience of nobody. You may have noticed my intentionally trying to avoid tipping my hand as to my opinions on the likelihood of wide Lightning adoption. I did this because A, what the hell do I know? And B, the last thing crypto needs is another person with strong opinions about what will or won't happen. Again, the goal here was primarily to inform and thought provoke, so hopefully it was helpful on those fronts. Thanks for reading, feedback welcome, and may your state channels runneth over. And that will conclude the excellent write-up by Daniel Goldman, titled The Lightning Network 2.0. I hope y'all enjoyed that one. That was a wonderful breakdown of each of the individual pieces. And believe it or not, I actually don't have a whole lot of commentary. I think he did a really good job of explaining them himself. And it was also really lengthy, so he kind of covered all the corners. I do have a couple of little nitpicks, or maybe not nitpicks, but just expansions that I consider, like, some of the limitations not really a huge concern. One of them with that I don't think he made mention of was that L2, and he talked about how Lightning Network channels have the normal punishment clauses, and they are done using the revoking previous states, whereas in this all just with HTLCs and check lock time. And however, the channel factories that he talked about use DMCs, the duplex multi-payment channels. And what those allow, he talks about, like, those need to be reset after a certain amount of time. Well, what's interesting, and I'm not sure if I have seen anything specifically say this, but everything I have read makes me think that this is applicable. The SIGHASH no input, the new script that L2 uses, that rather than having to keep the entire history of all the channel commitment states, you only need to keep the last state available in the L2 with the SIGHASH no input, and that's because they all have a sequence number. If I'm not mistaken, where that applies to Lightning Network by eliminating the punishment clause, that could also be the same setup used for a channel factory. So whereas the Lightning Network punishment clause doesn't really apply to the N of N multisig, and then the DMC of the N of N multisigs doesn't really well apply to the Lightning Network, if I'm not mistaken, I don't see any reason yet to think that the L2 SIGHASH no input with the sequencing cannot work on both the Lightning Network and the N of N channel factories. So I don't actually think the limitations and minor annoyances or refreshes that are required with the DMCs will be necessary if L2 or the SIGHASH no input and the L2 format is used to create channel factories. I could be wrong on that front, but it does not seem to me like it has the problem that the punishment clause has. Because literally all you need is a sequence, and as long as everybody is holding the later sequence, it doesn't matter whether you have two signatures on it or 16 signatures on it, you just need the last sequence, and it replaces the older ones. Then there was something else. Oh, the watchtower. He talked about how the watchtowers are a trusted setup, essentially, and in a lot of ways they are, like, kind of pseudo trusted, because as he says, what if this watchtower does nothing? So, you know, you get somebody to challenge a transaction that you had in one of your channels, your watch, you have to rely on your watchtower while you're not there to broadcast that on your behalf. And if that watchtower does not do so, that watchtower could collude with the attacker and say, okay, well, I'm not going to, I know he's away from his computer, so I'm not going to revoke the punishment or enact the punishment, and we will share all of the user's coins with the attacker. So the node, and, I mean, the watchtower and the attacker are attacking you. But that's not really, there's a lot of simple mitigations, and the watchtower system itself, because it's a service based on the Lightning Network, that's one thing that really fascinates me, and I love thinking about how to mitigate those things. And I know I've read a number of these, but I think these are just variations of just extrapolations that I've had from stuff that Alawalua, Roast Beef, I can't remember exactly how to pronounce his name, but like Roast Beef we talked about, because he has a hour-long or hour-and-a-half-long presentation on YouTube about just kind of watchtower stuff and mitigations. So even though everything Daniel Goldman said about watchtowers is technically true, and in the situation where you have one watchtower looking on your behalf, you have to trust that they're going to be there in your stead, there are a number of ways around this problem. First is that you could lock the fee for their service as part of the revoking process, which means watchtowers are just offering up this service for free until a revoking transaction is, or a disputed transaction hits the blockchain and they have to arbitrate on your behalf. But another thing that I thought was really interesting is that if the watchtower is colluding with the attacker, they're trying to get your coins, right? Well, the watchtower still runs the risk of you coming online and finding out that they're trying to, that everybody's trying to cheat you. But one thing is that the attacker, the watchtower's not risking anything here, but the attacker is. The attacker is risking all of their funds. So you could actually construct a transaction so that the watchtower could take the attacker's funds, because the watchtower could just as likely screw the attacker as they could screw you by not doing anything and then split it with the attacker. But you could set up the transaction in such a way that the watchtower just gets to take all of the thief's money, and then if you had like this built-in bounty system, why not just broadcast out your arbitration transaction to every watchtower out there, and then just have it so that their bounty is that if anybody tries to dispute it, they race each other to get the transaction in the next block that gives them, as opposed to the other watchtowers, the full payout of the attacker's coins. So the attacker has, or excuse me, the watchtower has no reason to split your coins with the attacker when they can get all of the attacker's coins in that scenario. I'm not sure if that's actually been programmed or written up in any way, because I know there's still a ton of work being done on the watchtower system, but that seems like a really interesting way to do it, is that, you know, as a user, all you're worried about is making sure that you don't get screwed out of coins. It doesn't really matter what happens to the thief's coins, so give it to the watchtower. Give it to the miner. You know, give it to whoever is going to make sure that the transaction goes the honest route. Kind of my favorite on the whole watchtower thing, which is just something that I'm thinking, like, how do I be my own watchtower, is what if you just build in your clients? There seems to be this general trend toward social media and money kind of slowly merging, and not necessarily like Facebook and payments, but in the sense that, you know, you, like, I've paid a ton of money back and forth through Square and Venmo with just friends for general things on many occasions, and we have our little friends lists, and it's getting to the point where, you know, you can send each other messages and Telegram and all these things like are adding little payment mechanisms and stuff so that you can chat and talk about what it is you're paying each other back for, so on and so forth. So what if you turn the Lightning client and their applications into mini watchtowers themselves with your social chat built on top of it? So you add your friends and family to your little Lightning Network wallet friends list, and every device that you have, so let's say you've got a you download the app on your desktop, your phone, your tablet, but then all of your friends have their devices, their tablets and phones and computers, and everybody in your friends list behaves as a little collective watchtower community. You're like the neighborhood watch for this, you know, inner circle of Lightning Network communication. And you could also half use that as like a little channel factory, but channel factories require a much more complexity, and everybody would have to be online at all times to make it worthwhile. But the watchtower back, using your friends as a watchtower backup, makes perfect sense, because just one of any of your friends and one of any of their devices has to be on at any one time, and you can give this service to each other for free. It can just be built into the chat, because it doesn't really cost anybody anything, and everybody would be willing to do it based on the reciprocal nature of knowing that everybody's got their back too, if anything happens. So there's not really any added benefit of even adding fees to that situation. And it could just be built in to all the clients, and you know, you set a friend and they are immediately one of your mini watchtowers in the network. So that's all I wanted to hit. I thought that was a interesting take on it, and I could easily see that being like a setup, or at least that would be something that I would want. You know, if I have a ton of friends who are in Bitcoin and, you know, want to try out Lightning and stuff. So if we were all each other's watchtowers, I wouldn't feel like I ever had to pay for a watchtower service. Outside of that, the article was just wonderful. I really appreciate this write-up. I can't imagine, it probably took forever. And this is a long freaking article here. It's a, even Medium says it's a 36-minute read. It's like a miniature book. So drop some massive applause on Daniel Goldman on Medium if you appreciated this article and enjoyed it as much as I did, because that's a lot of work to just post out on the internet for people to read. And that's just awesome. So thank you so much to Daniel Goldman and the Abacus Crypto Journal. If you would like to follow them, I will obviously have them tagged and linked in the post. You can find that also in yesterday's post, so it'll be available in both places. Don't forget to follow me at The Crypto Economy on Twitter, Mastodon, and Medium. You can find the Mastodon in the link in my Twitter description. If you would like to support the show, there's a number of different things you could do. You can leave a good review on iTunes. That makes a huge difference. You can share it with all your friends in the crypto space or anybody who's interested in learning more about it and, you know, just doesn't have the time to go reading and digging into all of this stuff. You can obviously subscribe to the iTunes podcast. If you have not done so yet, you definitely should. You don't want to miss any more of the great episodes we got coming up. And also, you could donate to the Bitcoin address that I'll have available, and that is a huge help. Thank you to all the people who have done that so far. It really means a lot. And obviously, I have my Trezor affiliate link, so that if you want to buy your Trezor hardware wallet to secure all your Bitcoin and cryptos, they have like 500 different tokens now that you can, or cryptocurrencies that you can put on the Trezor now. So literally, it is an all-in-one hardware wallet now. If you're holding anything that's not included in that 500, then you're too much of a gambler for me. You can use that affiliate link, and it won't cost you a dime, and it'll send a couple of bucks my way to help out the Crypto Economy podcast. All right, guys, I got a mower going in the background here, so I'm going to lose my sound here. And we will close this. Don't miss tomorrow's episode. We got another great one coming, and I've got some announcements coming at the end of this week. So stay tuned, guys. Don't miss the next couple of episodes. We got a lot of fun stuff to cover. I'll catch everybody tomorrow. Take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.